Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. If you think there are bad food deserts in cities across the United States, try finding some fresh produce in outer space. But that may be about to change. Last month, the latest SpaceX resupply capsule delivered a plant growth chamber to the International Space Station called Veggie that may someday soon produce NASA's first space salad. At $10,000 per pound, delivering food to the ISS isn't cheap, so learning to grow and harvest fresh food in outer space is a crucial step in the future of manned space exploration. Jesse Hirsch is a staff writer for Modern Farmer. I spoke to him about the Veggie program and about space farming in general in September. So up until now, what exactly have American astronauts been surviving on? We're talking Kraft mac and cheese and Tang, right?
Basically that, yeah. There's been some updates over the years. An article came out a couple of years back about how they're trying to go a little fancier with their food, but at the same time, they're limited by constraints of space, meaning how much space they actually have on the space station and how much it costs to send everything up there. So they look for things that are densely caloric, things that will not cost that much and will last the astronauts a long time.
So last year, American astronaut Don Pettit conducted some small-scale farming experiments. Tell us a little bit about what he was doing.
This was just mostly a personal project for him. He brought up a zucchini plant, which was the star of the show, as well as a couple of other plants that he said were keeping his zucchini company, a sunflower plant and a broccoli plant. And he basically just grew them in a very low-tech way, raised them on using compost from the food that they were eating, and he would move the plants around from window to window depending on where the space station was in relation to the sun. And he kept a blog using the voice of the zucchini called Diary of a Space Zucchini.
So on board the space station, astronauts experience, I think, 15 separate sunrises every 24 hours. So how does that unusual sun cycle and other things like zero gravity, for example, affect plant life? You know, how did they affect Don Pettit's plants?
Well, like I said, he was kind of winging it. He had not been fully trained on horticulture or what the plant needed. So I think that he just based it on instinct and was just moving it around based on whether the plants looked wilty or not. But the program that they are launching this year, they're not going to use the sun at all. They're actually going to use entirely LED lights.
So tell me a little bit about that program. You're talking about a plant experiment to grow lettuce.
To grow lettuce, yes. NASA is going to send up a program called Veggie, and it's the first time that they're ever going to be growing their own produce in space, potentially for the astronauts to eat. And so they're going to send up 6 romaine lettuce plants and grow them under LED lights, and the lettuce plants are very quick to grow, easy to harvest. You don't need much preparation after they're done growing, so they can just go directly to the astronauts.
You mentioned space being an issue on the space station. Obviously, there's not a lot of it. What are some of the other big challenges facing space farming that earthbound gardeners might not have to think about?
Well, there is also the fact that there are germs that NASA is very careful about not being consumed by the astronauts. These are things that typically are not too harmful. There's bacteria on our skin. There's bacteria everywhere here, but can have significantly more adverse effects up in space. Once they grow the first set of lettuce plants, they're going to be very cautious about whether or not they are going to be safe to be eaten.
You write that Russians are already allowed to eat space-grown vegetation. So the NASA astronauts aren't going to be able to eat their lettuce right away. That must be a little bit of a burn.
Yeah, it is a little bit of a burn. I don't think anyone's too happy about that. But I also got the sense that in talking to the scientists and astronauts, that they thought, well, you know, we'd rather be safe than sorry. We feel like the Russian side of the station is being a little lax, but I don't know if that's just the fact that they're sad that they don't get to eat it themselves.
We tend to think of growing food in space as fulfilling an obvious physical need, but you write that plant life also serves an emotional purpose for astronauts. How so?
Well, it's just been proven that tending a plant every day, the kind of the soothing zen of it, feeling like there's something in your care, kind of like taking care of a pet, can have immense psychological benefits. It's something that called horticultural therapy that's been tested out at prisons like Rikers Island, and it also has been shown, because there have been plants that were grown in space before, just not edible ones or ones that were able to be consumed by astronauts. And when you look at Don Pettit last year, for instance, it made his experience quite a bit better. The fact that he was tending these plants every day, it boosted his mood.
Yeah. In fact, his zucchini becomes something of an honorary crewmate in the diary.
Yes, I think he became quite close to it. I asked him if he would have been able to eat the zucchini or the broccoli, and he said that there was absolutely no way. He was too emotionally invested.
That was Jesse Hirsch, staff writer at Modern Farmer. You can read NASA's latest press release about the launch of Veggie at wordofmouthradio.org. Although NASA's Don Pettit has been back from his last mission aboard the ISS for over a year, his blog Letters to Earth remains one of the most fascinating and profound windows into the creative and emotional life of an astronaut. While in space, he penned and published poetry, An Astronaut's Guide to Space Etiquette, and the aforementioned series Diary of a Space Zucchini, which detailed life on the ISS from the unusual perspective of a self-conscious vegetable. We at Word of Mouth loved the latter so much, we decided it would make for some pretty compelling radio. So, without further ado, may we present Diary of a Space Zucchini, adapted from Don Pettit's blog, Letters to Earth, and starring NHPR's Sean Hurley as the courageous Squash and narrator himself.
January 5th, 2012. I sprouted, thrust into this world without anyone consulting me. I am not one of the beautiful ones. I am the kind that makes little boys gag at the dinner table. I am utilitarian, hardy, vegetative matter that can survive under harsh conditions. I am zucchini, and I am in space. January 14. My gardener fusses with me several times a day. He checks that I have water, light, and with a hypodermic syringe injects a tea-like concoction into the Ziploc bag which houses my roots. It's not very tasty, but I won't complain. On expeditions into the frontier, the food is often this way. February 3rd. I have learned that my gardener has a gardener too. Only his gardener does not water him, but speaks to him from a panel on the wall. His gardener must be very important. Everything stops whenever he calls.
3 minutes, LOS. All systems are go. Over.
Roger, thank you, Houston Apollo. March 10th. Sunflower's leaves are covered with brown spots. Both he and I are not feeling well. Broccoli seems to be doing okay. My gardener says it is something in the tea. March 11th. Broccoli is not doing well. His leaves are turning yellow. We are dying from some space malady. Gardener is frantically working to save us. I have heard that there is nothing to fear about the great compost. My only regret is that I will not be here on the frontier to help in this mission. March 23rd. We are recovering, growing greener every day. Our water diet was replaced with a new tea, one that is not salty. I have new leaves. I am no longer naked to the cosmos. June 12th. A great sadness has taken us all. Sunflower's sprout has died. He became weak, and his cotyledons could not emerge from the hull. We returned sprout to the compost from whence he came. I guess we were all made of recyclable materials. July 1st. Today, Gardner and his crew will depart in their seed pod. The replacement crew is ready to carry on in their place. He is wearing his spacesuit undergarments. Not too stylish, but functional. He gave all of us an extra long smell. He said that what will be is for the best. Gardner had tears in his eyes. He reached up and turned out the light. In the frontier, you should not be afraid of the dark.
That was NHPR's Sean Hurley, reading from Diary of a Space Zucchini by astronaut Don Pettit, excerpted and adapted for radio by Word of Mouth. We have links to Pettit's blog, Letters to Earth, at wordofmouthradio.org. And coming up after a break, The Birth of Cool. Stay with us for that story when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. The pursuit of cool has preoccupied our culture for decades. What may have started as an American quest has now spread around the globe, and everybody wants to be cool. And therein lies the rub. If you are trying to be cool, you probably aren't.
We're all going to be like three little Fonzies here. And what's Fonzie like?
Cool.
What?
Cool.
Correctamundo.
Late last year, Slate magazine ran a month-long series on the inexpressible but instantly recognizable concept of what it means to be cool. So Virginia sat down with senior editor Dan Coyce and asked, when did it become cool to be cool?
Well, it, of course, originally referred to the temperature, right? It referred to not warm, not hot, not cold, but just cool. It's climatic moderation, you know? But that, of course, is tied into the way we think of cool now. You're not too hot. You're not too cold. You're right on the level. You're cool. You're cool with whatever. And by the time of Shakespeare in A Midsummer Night's Dream, it was already being used to refer to sort of a moderation of emotion, a moderation of tone. Theseus tells Hippolyta, lovers and madmen have such seeming brains, but such shaping fantasies that apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends.
Hmm.
But by the 20th century, of course, it meant not just a moderation of your emotions, but it meant a whole attitude, a whole posture. And that came, it seems, to our writers and to most historians, that it came from African-American culture and then moved its way into sort of the majority monoculture to mean something more than just being okay with stuff, but having a certain je ne sais quoi about you that others might try to aspire to.
Which is so interesting, looking at, especially in the 1920s, certainly, when some of the first blues songs, cool kind daddy blues and that kind of thing were coming up in American popular culture. This was an era rife with, you know, lynchings, with riots against African Americans. So they become the standard bearers of cool while the most maligned population. What's going on there?
Well, there were sort of two parallel cultures happening at this time, right, in America, which is that the vast majority of the monoculture was discriminatory towards blacks and excluded them from society, but within sort of a certain area of, I guess you could call it early hipsterdom, that was where the cachet was. That society was what a certain class of people attempted to emulate. You know, and so there's always been a tradition of popular culture moving from the outside into the inside, right? And it happens even today. You know, the way that mainstream America deals with, you know, sex and drugs and anything that was once a lot more difficult for the mainstream to handle is now a lot different. And that's because things move from the outside to the inside. And this was just the beginning of that process, was the jazz and the fashion and the attitudes of a certain otherwise ostracized population were nevertheless moving their way into the mainstream.
Mm. We saw beat culture, later hippie culture, white people appropriating this kind of idea of cool. Looking from 2013 backwards, as you and so many other people on your staff did, what makes something cool?
Well, the easiest explanation of it, and one that doesn't really encompass everything about cool, but is sort of a great shorthand of looking at it, was Seth Stevenson's, which is not fully appropriate for radio, but is just not giving a darn, right? You know, simply not caring what other people think of you. And his example is Prince, right? Prince clearly does not give 12 darn, as Seth says slightly more vulgarly in our pages. He doesn't care what you think about him, and so he will wear purple, frilly, ruffly whatevers, but it doesn't matter because he's so amazing. He's so cool that he can get away with it. There's that aspect of cool. Then there's the aspect of cool, which is simply sort of aesthetic, minimal elegance, right? You know, Mark Joseph Stern for this series wrote a great piece declaring the coolest thing that anyone has ever worn, the coolest fashion item that has ever been worn. And he declared that it was Cary Grant's sunglasses in North by Northwest because they're a little bit awkward as a fashion object. They're a little bit big. They have these sort of weird green lenses, but he wears them so effortlessly and perfectly, and they work so well with his look and the image that he puts forth in that movie. He wears them in the train scene when he's seducing Ava Marie Saint, that they, by that nature, become sort of the epitome of coolness, of mid-century coolness that people are still trying to evoke today.
You feel you've seen me somewhere before?
Mm-hmm.
Funny how I have that effect on people. It's something about my face.
It's a nice face.
You think so?
I wouldn't say it if I didn't.
Oh, you're that type.
What type?
Honest.
The sunglasses are part of a sort of toolkit. You know, the dangling cigarette, the leather jacket. You know, I'm thinking of Marlon Brando or James Dean. But it's interesting that the idea and concept of cool has endured. But we don't say, you know, what a swell bunch of fellows, you know, or groovy,
right,
or dope. But we still say cool. Why has that lasted?
Well, that's a totally hep question, you know. It's lasted, I think, because it's flexible enough to be updated, you know, from era to era. You know, the rebel cool of Marlon Brando is not exactly the same as the funk cool of the 70s, but they share a certain attitude. They share a certain sort of spirit. In the same way, the term is flexible enough to be sort of appropriated in the 90s and in this century by the tech world.
We're speaking with Dan Coyce, senior editor at Slate Magazine. He's a contributor and has been working on this series, a month-long series about cool and what it means now in 2013, looking at aspects of fashion and attitude and dance. And you, as you just mentioned, technology, internet and social media expose things much faster and wider than culture has ever been able to move. So how long is it possible for something to stay cool?
It seems like you can measure it in seconds for many things, you know, and it sort of depends on your perspective. If you are 23 and you live in Brooklyn, then Haim, you know, the band Haim, was cool in June. But they're already not cool anymore. But whereas if you're me, a 38-year-old guy in the suburbs, Haim just started being cool like yesterday.
Well, that's part of it.
But I'm hopelessly uncool for thinking so.
But that's kind of the catch-22, right? That coolness wears off as soon as everybody else recognizes it. You can be wearing like skinny jeans tucked into boots, and that's cool, and then they're selling it at the Limited. You know what I mean? Or everyone's wearing it at the mall, and it's no longer cool.
Right. Well, it's even more than just when you recognize it. It's like the second I wear skinny jeans, they're no longer cool. And so I think that's sort of the fun of exploring this, is trying to understand why it is that something moves from cool to uncool while it has differing levels and has a differing evolution throughout its life. And, you know, that makes it, if you are really a cool hunter, right, if that is something that you want in your life, that makes it a real challenge to stay up to date. On the other hand, you can also argue that if you explicitly are a cool hunter and definitively want that in your life, you are by definition uncool. Mm-hmm. Cary Grant wasn't trying to be cool. He just was cool. Prince isn't trying to be cool. He just is cool. If you're trying that hard, forget it, man. You're totally uncool.
Well, and you're also pointing out something, that it is not a permanent state, you know, because it does evolve.
Yeah.
I mean, John Travolta as Tony Manero in Saturday Night Fever, cool. John Travolta dancing with Uma Thurman in Pulp Fiction, what do you think there?
Oh, that's still cool. That was like a reborn cool.
All right, how about Battlefield Earth?
Right, John Travolta showing up at a premiere now, not cool. But we can still look back at those and see and experience their cool again, even with, you know, the ephemeral nature of that in the forefront of our minds. We know that John Travolta is no longer cool, but you can still watch that scene in Saturday Night Fever and be swept up in it enough to understand how amazing that seemed in 1979. You know, I can understand why people looked at that and said, oh man, I want to be like that.
We just washed the hair. You know, I work on my hair a long time, and you hit it. He hits my head.
Dan Coyce, senior editor at Slate Magazine, speaking with Virginia Prescott. You can find a link to Slate's series on Cool and listen to a Cool versus Uncool quiz that Virginia played with Dan after the interview at wordofmouthradio.org.
Taxidermy. Is taxidermy cool?
Taxidermy is not cool except for in very specific sections of artisanal Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
TED Talks.
Totally uncool. So uncool.
Turned the corner, huh?
You think all the effort that people put into those, totally uncool.
All right. Let's see. Dog rehab.
From what? Bone addiction?
Yeah. I don't know.
I didn't even know this was a thing.
It turns out what is and isn't cool has a lot to do with how old you are. Coming up after a break, we'll speak with rock star turned children's musician Chris Ballew. Stay with us for that when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott.
Six black cherries and the juice of a lime. Barbecue sauce and a grapefruit rind. One part water, six parts gin. A cup of mud and an octopus gin. Bubble.
You're listening to the song Electric Spider by the Presidents of the United States of America. Earlier this year, the same band responsible for the 1995 hit single Lump released their sixth studio album called Kudos to You. It was their first since 2008. Over the last 6 years, President's frontman Chris Ballew has been keeping himself busy making music geared towards an entirely different generation of listeners, the 3- and 4-year-old set.
Highway sign, greasy spoon, CB radio, butterfly driving a truck.
Under the alias Casper Baby Pants, Chris has released 7 albums of children's music, including a collection of Beatles tunes, all in the past 5 years. Virginia spoke with Chris in January, just before the release of his new album, to find out what it's like to go from rocker to Raffy and back again.
So what inspired you to make music for kids? I'm guessing it might have been having a kid.
Actually, no. It's funny. Well, my wife is a bit of a kid, although not in age, but in mentality. Not that she's damaged or anything. She's fine. but she is an artist, and she makes this incredibly well-crafted, bright, folksy, whimsical collage art full of animals. And I looked at that art and realized, you know what? I want to make music that sounds like that art looks. Hmm. Aside from the band, I had been sort of searching for a long, long time to find another voice that was quieter and more innocent and simpler without really knowing what the purpose was going to be. So I see her art. I made a few songs to go along with a few pieces of her art. When I listened back, I realized it's kids' music. And I'm 7 records later, I'm still going strong.
Wow. So what is that difference that you talked about between making music for adults and for toddlers? Is it about writing or song structure or production?
You know, I look at it as sort of an energetic thing. You know, I tend to look at sort of the end product. Now, with the Presidents, my focus is on making a room full of people at a live show really come alive and smile and feel like they're in on the show and that we're no better than them in a fundamental kind of punk rock way. You could do this too. We're just like you. And with the Casper stuff, my real purpose is to give families music that they can all really honestly enjoy. You know, I want to take care of the parents' aesthetic needs and the children's aesthetic needs. And finding that balance is a real creative challenge.
I saw Hobo Baby leaving on a trip. Diaper for a suitcase sticking out his lip. Baby eats a berry, baby eats a plum. When that baby has nothing to eat, that baby sucks its thumb. Get along home, hobo baby, get along home, 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 get along home. Go gonna cradle you someday. Get along home, home, home. Get along home.
Well, here's one of those songs that could be shared. Hobo Baby. Pretty funny.
That's my wife's favorite Casper Baby Pants song.
Well, I'm gonna side with her on this one. And it's very funny in ways that a toddler may not necessarily understand. They'll just like it. Is the idea to keep parents happy too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I really feel like I actually make parents' music. I think about a family in a car who is hungry and tired and hot and irritable, and I literally put myself in that car as I write, record, and mix and arrange these albums. I keep going back to, is this going to help that family? Is that banjo too prickly? You know, and I'll just erase it and say, yep, yep, there it is. Oh, now the song is breathing and it can help.
You know, Chris, I listened to that song and there's something wonderfully new and wonderfully familiar about it. Is that a way that you're approaching this music?
Absolutely. I find myself listening to a lot of music from before the turn of the century, slave chants, prison songs, blues, old folk music, and finding that there's a nature to that music that is about saving your soul. You know, sometimes that music was the difference between life and death, and those rhythms were the difference between making it that through that day and not. And I use some of those rhythms as foundations to build my own new songs from. I did a record called Sing Along. I think it was my sixth or fifth record. I took a lot of the grooves and the setups from old call and response music from, like, you know, prison songs and stuff like that. So, yeah, I know being a parent is a little bit like being in a penitentiary in 1887.
Are you a bad blue jay?
Yes, sir.
Did you scare away the birds?
Yes, sir.
Are they ever coming back?
No, no, no.
And their song be heard?
Tweet, tweet, tweet.
Are you a bad blue jay?
Yes, sir.
Are you pushy and loud?
Yes, sir.
Do you make a noise?
Chainsaw.
Could you turn it down?
No, no, no.
Are you a bad blue?
Well, let's go back and forth here with Casper Baby Pants and the Presidents of the United States of America, because your sixth studio album is going to be released next month. So we're going to hear another song from the grown-up part of your personality or guest band. This is Good Morning Tycoon.
Pluck that guitar all day long. Never guilty, never wrong. Just enough money to buy some quality food. Life was so smooth. Then something clicked, we're not sure what. Got the gold, if you got the guts, let us get the check, cause we don't wanna be rude. That fancy alcohol stew, it was the leisure, let the pleasure come through. Good morning, tycoon. Good morning, tycoon. Surrounded by sawed oak and silver spoons. Good morning, tycoon. Good morning, tycoon. You want the sun, you settle for the silver moon. Silver moon.
You have been Casper Baby Pants now for 7 albums, making children's music. I'm wondering if all that time writing and playing music for kids has influenced your work for the Presidents at all. Does anything bleed through?
Yeah, that's interesting. I thought when we went in to record a couple of songs, I thought, can I bring the innocent Casper Baby Pants into the Presidents? I think the President's music I've learned from doing the Casper thing and having this other voice, I've learned the strength of the Presidents is when innocence rubs up against innuendo, which is in itself an innuendo. So when there's friction between the innocent sort of, you know, like a dune buggy or a kitty or a peach or a spider, an electric spider or whatever that is, when the friction is there between innocence and innuendo, that's when the band really comes to life. So although I thought at first I could go in and say, hey, could we just do really simple little innocent songs, I realized that our chemistry really comes from that reaction. Also, Casper, I need that because it's an opportunity for me not to kind of have the pressure to apply that level of innuendo.
Hi, so you get to play out this whole other part of yourself as a songwriter.
Yeah.
Do any of your band work with you on Casper Baby Pants, or are they two sort of distinct projects?
They're pretty distinct. The Casper thing is really a solo endeavor. I mean, I feel more like a sculptor almost than a musician when I'm working on that stuff. I have to find the song in the mess. You know, I'll start recording and I'll record everything and put it, you know, all these instruments on a song. And then the trick is removing as much as possible. So it's a long sort of experimental process. And the trick with working with others in that scenario is people get attached to their parts. You know, if I want to erase the guitar completely in Casper, I just do it because it serves the song. Whereas in The President's, erasing the guitar part is a potential political disaster.
Well, that's so, it's so interesting because you describe the inspiration for this as something visual, as the energy and brightness and color of your wife's collages. How does the visual work with you in creating this Casper Baby Pants thing?
Oh, it's gigantic in both The President's and Casper Baby Pants. The best songs that I have are born from a vision in my mind of something hilarious or weird or just a crazy vision. You know, Lump, everybody says, what's Lump about? Well, listen to it, and that's what it's about.
Lump sat alone in a boggy marsh, totally motionless except for her heart. Mud flowed up into Lump's pajamas. She totally confused all the passing piranhas. She's Lump, she's Lump, she's in my head.
That's what Lump was about, is just a woman in a house coat sitting in a river confusing the piranhas as they swim by, you know. For some reason, that's what I saw. And the best Casper songs are like that, too. You know, me describing something crazy that popped into my head.
I'm thinking now, Chris, about being a parent, driving with a kid, listening to songs over and over and over again, and you giving them something interesting to hang on to. But at the same time, kids are going to remember that forever. You know, 3 and 4 year olds that have been listening to your music are now 10, and they're going to grow up. I'm wondering what you think of your musical legacy. I mean, are you going to be remembered longer for the Presidents of the United States or Casper Baby Pants?
I hope that both, you know, endure. I do kind of feel like the Casper thing is going to keep cycling around, because my hope is that these kids that are growing up with it now are then going to need it for their kids, you know, and it's going to start this kind of endless cycle of regeneration, which would be really, really satisfying.
My little lumberjack, you don't want you back. In fact, I never want you to leave.
Musician Chris Ballew is the frontman for the Seattle-based rock band The Presidents of the United States of America. He also makes music as the toddler rock icon Casper Baby Pants. You can find out more about Chris and his music at wordofmouthradio.org. This tune is called Poor Little Me, and it's off The President's newest album, Kudos to You.
Carved a name into my loving tree. Climbed up to the top so she could see.
Chris has been able to make a good living off of music by expanding his repertoire, but a lot of other musicians aren't so lucky. For a new series called Day Job, How Musicians Pay the Rent, producer Joshua McNichols examines the backstage lives of aspiring artists. Here's episode 1, The Bitter Barista.
Matt Watson is a musician. He performs under the name Speculation, spelled with a K, and he's a rapper and a producer. And a few days a week, he works as a barista in a tiny coffee shop in Seattle's Beacon Hill neighborhood.
Describe what it looks like.
600 square feet, homey, a lot of wood, 5 or 6 tables, old espresso machine, and usually a lot of loud music.
It's called The Station. This is not Matt's first job making espresso. He's had another. Back then, he was a hotshot barista at a much more popular coffee shop in Seattle's Georgetown neighborhood. After working all day at that coffee shop, he'd hole up in his studio and work alone on his hip-hop music.
Basically, my life at that point was work in a coffee shop 5 days a week, come home, go immediately to the studio, work there for 7-8 hours, go to bed, start over in the morning, maybe try and squeeze in dinner with my wife there someplace. But I was tired when I got home, and it was a slog.
Am I a workaholic all in or a big city bore? I'm not entirely sure what my wife thinks anymore. Truth be told, she's got the patience of a saint, cause rap records don't cover insurance and word the payment's late. I say it monthly, when statements come we make, scrape and save a way to pay him something. It'd be one thing if I wasn't loose, every single dollar I put into this news.
Matt created a secret blog where he could vent his frustration. He started posting nasty comments about coffee shop customers and his boss.
Here are a few examples from bitterbarista.com. The coffee of the day is an Ethiopian dark roast blended with broken dreams and despair. Lady, you're drinking coffee through a straw. I hardly think you're in the position to lecture me on lifestyle choices.
Then, Matt was outed.
And this is the one that probably got me fired. I like to use a lot of big words when I tweet. That way, if my boss ever finds my Twitter account, he won't understand any of it.
You might think Matt would never work in espresso again after that debacle, but he'd been hanging out at the station, and this coffee shop felt different. And so Matt Watson decided to give his espresso career one more shot. A customer named Moni Tepp approaches the counter. Turns out she's a musician too. She performs under the name Just Moni.
As a musician, you're a little far removed sometimes because you're always playing shows and you're always in the studio and you're always making music. Coffee shop gives you a space to, like, talk about real life with people. You know what I'm saying? Like, real life. You get to talk about real life.
Moni heads back to her seat, where she and the musician Paolo Escobar are working on a music track on a laptop. No more. Then Paolo pulls out his guitar. Matt has started working more with live musicians now, the kind of musicians who come into this coffee shop. Now, when he sees a customer, he doesn't see a potential adversary. He sees a potential collaborator.
I think a year ago when I got fired from that place, that was a huge blessing for me to come and find this place.
Matt hasn't given up on the bitter barista persona completely. He's got a coffee table book out and, you know. But the nasty comments online, they've slowed way down. And when you look at his face, Matt doesn't look bitter anymore. He looks happy.
That piece was produced by Joshua McNichols for his new series, Day Job, How Musicians Pay the Rent. There's a link to his website where you can listen to the rest of the series at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, some fresh music you can listen to. Producer Zach Nugent brings us his monthly Audio Orchard. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a break. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. It's May Day, and we thought we'd celebrate with some new music. Here with his favorite songs of the month is producer Zach Nugent in a segment we call The Audio Orchard.
Even though spring is just warming up, I'm already looking forward to the summer. The first song on this month's playlist is by the undeniably cheery band Quantum Keys. The song is called Keep Good Habits. Life of a dead star. Quantum Keys is a brand new band from California, and from the sound of this song, their biggest influence is probably California. Part Strokes, part Beach Boys, I have a feeling I'll be listening to this song all summer on my way to the beach with the windows rolled down. The next song in this month's playlist is We Like the Zoo Cause We're Animals Too by Walter Martin.
We like the zoo cause we're animals too. We like the zoo cause we're animals too. We like the zoo cause we're animals too. We wanna do like the monkeys do.
Walter Martin is from the New York City indie rock band The Walkmen. They're the type of band you wouldn't expect to be writing children's songs, and I think that's why I like this song. It's so unexpected. Martin says he wrote the song as a tribute to the lost art of the novelty song. He says old novelty songs like Yakety Yak made a big impression on him. I'm pretty sure he's not being ironic, but you can never tell with these Brooklyn indie rockers. Anyway, this song is like a Pixar film. Fun for the whole family.
No, I'm not covered with fur. No, and I don't stink. And I don't breathe underwater. Cause the good Lord knows I'd sink. La, 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 la. And you'd never guess from just what you see. But you gotta face it, mama, there's a beast in me. We like the zoo cause we're animals too.
The next song on the playlist is Stop Your Crying by Lake Street Dive. Lake Street Dive played here at NHPR a couple years ago, and since then they've blown up, playing festivals and making TV appearances over the last year. They're a four-piece band from Brooklyn, classically trained in jazz at the New England Conservatory of Music, and now they're playing 60s-era pop. Their new album, Bad Self-Portraits, is their first collection of original material in over 3 years. It's one of my favorite albums of the year so far. Lake Street Dive will be playing a bunch of shows in New England this summer, so be sure to check them out.
So stop your crying. You know I'll be the one to let you back in. I'm so sick of lying, telling myself it's the end. I know better, but here I go again.
Okay, if all these songs have been a bit too cheery, the next song on the playlist will provide some much-needed balance. It's called Every Time the Sun Comes Up by Sharon Van Etten. The song is the last track on Sharon Van Etten's forthcoming album, Are We There? It's out this month. I would describe Van Etten as a moodier version of Feist. So if you need to wallow a bit about this rainy spring, this song can be your shoulder to cry on.
Even when the sun comes up, I'm in trouble.
As always, you can find Zach's full playlist at wordofmouthradio.org. And what about you? Do you have a new song you can't stop listening to? We want to hear it. So post a link to your favorite new track on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, and help us create a community-sourced playlist we can all enjoy.
Yeah, every time the sun comes up, I'm in trouble.
Thanks for joining us today. If you missed anything, listen back at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or share your ideas for the program on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter, @wordofmouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. She'll be back with more on Saturday at noon on New Hampshire Public Radio.